The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film.
We're putting on red jackets this week as we refrain from calling each other chicken and wonder, what's living? All while I figure out how to achieve hair like James Dean. We're talking Rebel Without a Cause this week on Zach on Film.
Hello, Zach.
Hello, Steven.
1955's Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
Our movie this week.
That's a movie.
Based on a 1934, doctor kind of thing about what's wrong with kids these days.
Yeah, it was really weird when I read that. I mean, it kind of makes sense, but then they were like, oh, they didn't use like anything from the film.
I think they honestly
just wanted the title.
Warner Brothers just wanted the title.
Yeah.
And they bought it. But it's based on the title comes from psychiatrist Robert L. Linder's 1944 book, Rebel Without a Cause, a hypnoanalysis of a criminal psychopath. I think there's a psychopath in this film. Couple of them, perhaps, in this film. But basically, the movie starts off at a police station where we're introduced to a drunk, a whore, and a psychopath.
Yeah.
And this is their story.
Yeah, that's pretty much what
That's basically how they're classified. I mean, yeah. James Dean's character, Jim Stark, is picked up for public drunkenness. Mm-hmm. This is Easter Sunday.
Right.
Natalie Wood's character is picked up for walking the streets at night.
Yes.
And there's the implications in the conversation she has with the police officer that she goes with boys goes with boys in air quotes.
Yes, yes.
As a reaction to not getting affections from her father.
Right.
To get a rise out of him.
Right.
And then we're introduced to the psychopath, this 15-year-old who goes around killing puppies because his mom and dad aren't there.
Yeah.
And that was the most disturbing part of the whole movie. Why do you kill? Why did you shoot those puppies? Have you ever thought about sending him to a psychiatrist? Oh, no. The missus doesn't believe in that head shrinking stuff.
Here's the thing about this. And I think this is important. Like the cop's reaction to him shooting puppies isn't that drastic.
Uh-uh.
Yeah.
Later on, Jim brings up like when they're like walking around that abandoned house, they're talking about kids and how they're terrible.
Right.
They're
right.
Like, oh, you should drown them like puppies.
Right.
Like
right,
put them in a bag and drown them like puppies. I think in 1955, it was just okay to kill dogs.
Yeah. I kind of agree with that, but
yeah.
It is, especially knowing what we know these days, that you know that first mark of the sociopath is injuring smaller animals,
working
your way up to killing people. But that sequence and just the way that it's so deadpan and so quiet, there's no anger from Plato. There's no real accusation from the cop. It's more of a, why'd you do it, Johnny? Why would you do that? Why'd you throw a bottle through the front window of old man Rogan's tavern? Right. You know, it's not you murdered animals. It's why'd you do something dumb to get in trouble?
Yeah.
Well, I think that reaction kind of goes through the whole movie. I mean, there's a couple kids that die. And it sometimes doesn't seem like anyone cares, and everyone's actually kind of happy.
So keep in mind that this story takes place literally within a 24-hour time period.
No,
I understand. It starts at 3 a.m. in the morning on Sunday and ends 3 a.m. in the morning on essentially Tuesday.
Sure.
Or 3 a.m. Monday morning to 3 a.m. Tuesday morning.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you look at the death of Buzz,
right.
Everyone doesn't really react that horribly to it. And then you have the death of Plato at the end.
Yes.
And then...
spoiler.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sure. Spoiler.
So maybe Zach...
Well, no, so Jim walks off with a lady friend.
Yes, Judy.
And the parents are tickled. They're like, oh, our boy is a girl. And his friend is laying there dead, shot by the cops. What a happy ending.
But you have to also look at... There's the aspect of relief that it wasn't their boy,
right?
That got shot, that needed to get shot. And I think that there, you know, there's an element psychologically of what's the word I'm looking for? Of numbness to everybody in this film, because nobody has psychologically really, really violent reactions to anything except for Jim. And when he has them, everybody just looks at him uncomfortably, like he's doing something wrong, but they don't respond in kind and they don't go, Jim, what's wrong with you? You're over the top. They're just like, oh, son.
Yeah. Well, but again, time period. And, you know, they keep saying, oh, 10 years from now, you'll have a whole different perspective on this. We are, you know, 50, 60 some years out from this movie, right?
Yes.
Or nearly 60 years out from this movie. Yeah. And I really do not like this movie. I know a lot of people applaud James Dean for his acting. I did not care for any of the acting from any actors in this piece, even Jim Bakus. I didn't really care for it. But just because everyone is so very wooden and so very, we're delivering our lines very slowly and we're not getting emotional. And so from that perspective, I don't really care for it. From the psychological, let's take a look and see what's going on with teenagers at the time and the fact that we're looking at teenagers in a suburban environment. Los Angeles is a suburban environment. Okay. But we're looking at, you know, just a few years before we had what's his name? Superman's father, Jor-El, dressing up in biker gear and running down the road on motorcycles and being motorcycle gang and people saying, well, this is what our society is coming to with these punk kids coming back from the war and everything. And now this is almost like, well, what's going on in suburbia, right? We've seen what happens to the New York kids. We've seen what happens to the inner city kids with the gangs. What are these suburban kids doing? And we kind of get this right now. And, you know, if people want to see emo children, we've got it in Plato and Jim and Judy. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if Matthew and I and Rodrigo all think back to when we were in our early to mid teens, 15 through 18. Yeah, we were probably going through a lot of these same things, too. My parents don't understand me. I don't belong. I'm constantly being picked on and I'm trying to deal with these things. But now, you know, 30 years out from that, for Matthew and I, a little bit more than 30. Well, no, a little bit under 30, thank God. 30. but not by much, though. Not by much. You know, now we look back on it, and it's like, you know, that was all just part of the growing up. And I wonder, Zach, if you kind of, you're a little bit closer to the age that the characters are supposed to be in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, you're from a smaller community and not, you know, something like this.
Sure.
But did you get that sense of, oh, you know, life is boring. We're all going to die and this is meaningless and I can find no meaning in my life.
From this movie or from life?
No, I mean, did you see those parallels from when you were in high school in this movie?
Yeah, I think you could draw a line between feelings that teenagers have and what is generally represented in this film. I think a line that would probably connect with me, teenage self, or others is when Buzz and Jim are ready to do the Chicky Run.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim's like, oh, why do we do this?
Yeah.
And then Buzz says, like, we got to do something or something along those lines. I feel like there's a sense of that in teenage lives. Like, oh, we might as well just do something.
Yeah,
does it matter if it's completely reckless or not?
Yeah. Go ahead, Rodrigo.
I think that's the reason I think why Rebel Without a Cause is so resonant is because, I mean, I don't know if it was the very first, but it's one of the first suburban teenager
right.
movies.
Right.
Yeah.
And one thing that suburban teenagers have that a lot of urban teenagers have, and this is also true for kids that grow up in the country, is boredom.
Yeah.
There's not as much to do in the suburbs as there is in a city. And in a city, especially if you're a low-income person, or you live in a really bad neighborhood, part of your time is spent kind of trying to avoid trouble or getting yourself into the level of trouble that you that is going to get you paid or whatever, right?
Right.
But in the suburbs, you don't have that. So these kids do all these crazy things because they're bored, which I find extremely interesting. It's just the lengths to which they go right to the point of endangering their lives and past it.
Yeah.
Because they're bored.
Yeah, let's have a knife fight. We're not going to really hurt each other. We're just going to poke each other a little bit.
Have a knife.
You know, but the interesting thing I was going to say, the interesting thing here is, and I don't know about the 60s because maybe this movie came out right at the right point and then James Dean dying right before the movie's release caused it to be popular for the next decade. But if you look, you know, like in the 80s, we've got The Breakfast Club, which is kind of this without anybody really dying. We look at Boys in the Hood. Mm-hmm. We've got that same thing. I mean, you have, it seems like in every generation, a movie that says, well, here's what teenagers are thinking right now, and here's why teenagers are acting this way. But if you were to watch all of those movies in a row, you'd find out that there are extreme parallels between all the characters on all those films and this general sense of where is my place in this world and how am I supposed to act and why am I? And we see this a lot with Natalie Wood's character, Judy. She wants attention from her father, which she now suddenly doesn't get because she's developed a body that now probably makes the father uncomfortable. And he thinks that, oh, you're too old for that kind of stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And so she doesn't know how to react to this. And she's looking for this. And poor Plato, who doesn't have a father or a mother who's always absent. And then James Dean's character, Jim, whose father is really just kind of henpecked and won't stand up for himself.
And I think almost more importantly, won't give him any direction in life,
right, right.
And won't give him really any boundaries or anything.
Right, right. So, again, look at Breakfast Club and look and see how many of those characters have some of the same characteristics that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
You come from a violent home. You come from a place where your parents don't respond to you, the Ally Sheedy character. You look at Jim Stark was supposed to be a lot more nerdy in this film than he was. But then you got James Dean, good-looking 24-year-old playing a 17-year-old.
They would try to put glasses on him, and they would disintegrate.
Yeah, they wanted him to wear more tweedy jackets instead of the red jacket that they eventually went with. But yeah, he was supposed to be much more of a nerdy character. Matthew, what were you going to say a little bit ago? I'm sorry.
It's really important to think about the fact that the 1950s is really the point where adolescence as we know it became recognized as a thing. Because prior to that, in a lot of ways, you're 13, you're a man now. And this is the point where society started recognizing those, you know, 12 to 18, those ages as separate of childhood, but also not quite adult. And I think that, you know, from my perspective, if you look at this movie, I don't think that this is just another, oh, what the kids are up to movie. I think this is also kids trying to come to terms with the fact that they're not kids, but they're not adults. Because, I mean, there's that scene where Jim is like, what do you do when you got to be a man?
Yeah.
That's the big question of this film for me is he's not a man. He cannot yet be a man. But throughout that film, throughout the experience of the film, he keeps bumping up against situations where he either feels he needs to be, really wants to be, or, you know, at near the end, flat out has to become a grown up, has to be the man that he doesn't know how to be because his you know, his father is not what he needs to be. And I think that one of the really telling moments for me in this movie is the moment that Rodrigo mentioned where he's like, children should be put in a sack and drowned. But he says that as an incredibly dead-on impersonation of Jim Backus.
Right. Well, right. Of Mr. Magoo.
Mr. Magoo. Yeah.
But Jim Backus. And Jim right. Backus, when, in this movie, when he's speaking, you can hear the Magoo in his voice. You can hear that speech pattern. You know that what he is doing at that moment is he's putting himself in the role of, I'm going to be the de facto parent in this, you know, this moment, right. this unit, whatever.
Right.
This is how I know how to be a father. And that those are the kind of really quiet moments where I say the acting of James Dean is utterly phenomenal. It is literally incredible the amount of depth that he brings to moments that are just quiet moments. You're thinking, no, he just, oh, wait a minute. I never realized that until afterwards. The fact that when he was in that situation, the most horrible, the most spineless, the weirdest thing he could think of to say came out in an exaggeration of the voice of his actual father. And Dean managed to do that in such a way that it was there if you wanted it.
Oh, yeah.
And if it wasn't, it was just a funny voice and a funny line.
No. I think everybody got that part, understood that he was being his father and that Natalie Wood was being her mother. And poor Plato was just caught as this lovesick puppy child who was going to be drowned by getting thrown in the swimming pool. From the story perspective, whoever was saying a moment ago about that James Dean Jim actually has to grow up and become a man at the end of the movie. And I think that, you know, there's that scene in the cop car where Jim's mother and it's talking right at the audience to a point where she's like, oh, you never think that this is going to happen to your child. And it's kind of beating it over the head. Like,
not to a point. She's looking right at the camera. Yeah.
You never think it's going to happen to your child. And you're like, oh, God, please. I know what you're trying to say is there are troubled youths out there and parents need to pay more attention to their kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But at times this movie becomes a little bit too preachy for me. And I don't know. I think that's – I don't know if it's the preachy factor or the fact that – and I'm not saying everyone's a terrible actor, but the pacing is so slow and the lines are delivered in such a way that it just is – it's almost a two-hour movie that could have been cut down to about 90 minutes, I think.
I agree. I agree that the pace is kind of slower than it wants to be, but I think to a certain degree that is just the pacing that people were used to. I was surprised at how long this movie was, because if you think back on it, like, plenty happens, but I mean, honestly, this is like, I don't know, you could have done this in an hour. You could have done this in 90 minutes instead of 100 and whatever.
Now, go ahead.
I'm kind of glad that they did, because one of the things that in that first, you know, that first sequence where Jim's in the room with the chief of control and they're having their little rap session and the chief is trying to be, you know, that the police officer is trying to be that welcoming ear to try and keep him from becoming a full-fledged juvenile delinquent. And we have that moment where James Dean is doing the slow burn. And the slow burn, and finally it turns into that really possibly overly melodramatic outbreak of violence. I really found myself enjoying the fact that they let that moment build and build and build to the point where when it exploded, it was one of those moments where you're like, yeah, you know, he's been sitting here and this whole thing is just bubbling up. And I can understand why that scene specifically, but a couple of others go as long as they do, because as a, you know, the consumer, as the person watching this, I was like, oh, my God, this is so uncomfortable. This is so just, oh, somebody yell, somebody kick, somebody scream. And when it happens, it's almost kind of satisfying when he flips out and starts punching the solid oak desk and hurts himself really bad.
Yeah, hurt himself really bad, had to wear a sling for a while on that because of that. You know, my issues of the pacing and acting aside, I still find this fascinating from the storytelling. Even though it is 2 hours, I sat up well until past 2 a.m. watching this movie and really enjoying it from the, okay, what is the underlying message? What are the character motivations? What is, you know, what is driving these characters and how do they fit into these various tropes? You know, I really enjoyed watching the movie from that perspective because I haven't watched it from that perspective before. Mm-hmm. The last time it's just like, come on, get on with it, kid. You know, do something. Or, you know, come on, Jim Bacchus, stand up and tell your kid to stay home and go to his room or do something and shut up, mom, or whatever. That's what needed to happen. I felt the first time I watched this movie and was really greatly unsatisfied. Matthew was, I don't know if you were live tweeting this earlier today, Matthew, but you had commented that, oh, I thought this movie was in black and white. And probably because when we saw it in film class the first time, we may have been watching it on some crappy TVs that were probably better off than black and white. But on a technical side, originally they'd shot a portion of this movie in black and white because it was going to be one of Warner Brothers B movies.
Mm.
Right. And then I guess what's the movie that came out just before this with James Dean? It got so well. He was up for an Academy Award.
East of Eden.
Yeah,
East of Eden. And suddenly they said, oh, we need to now move this up and make this a bigger picture. And we need to do this in color. So that's when they went back and reshot everything in color. That's when the red jacket came into existence and created really an iconic look.
Yeah.
That still today is you can look at Fry from Futurama and you can go, that's James Dean right there. Mm-hmm. With the hair.
Around, I'm like, why does James Dean look like Fry? But one thing that I did find in terms of just the construction, I wasn't bothered by the pacing, but you know what I hated more than anything on planet Earth?
Jim Bacchus.
Chewbacca's wife. Cues.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The music is overblown, fully orchestrated. It goes from maudlin to dun, dun, dun. the music, the movie's really good, and I liked the performances. I felt like the quiet, almost zombified performances.
Let me ask you a question about those performances.
Okay.
Did you – and again, I had to go back and I had to do some rereading on James Dean because there were moments where, you know, Plato totally idolizes Jim Stark in this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Plato loves Jim Stark.
Well, but see, I think it goes beyond just that I love you like my father figure to I think Jim Stark was in love with – I mean, not the Jim Stark. Plato was in love with Jim Stark, and I think there may have been some – hints of mutual attraction between the two characters.
Did that come off? Yes, absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And
I think that's one of those things where I don't think that was purposeful, but Rebel Without a Cause in 1955 was a movie about this do-nothing kid who is way too emotional for his own good and is doing stupid things, who befriends this other kid who wants him to be his dad.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, Rebel Without a Cause is about this movie about the only sane man in a world where everybody behaves like a robot.
Yes.
And he has a gay psychopath who's in love with him.
Yes.
Like, it becomes something completely different.
But also, you know, just this... as the characters are interacting with one another, this feeling that Jim, who is lost and doesn't know what he wants to do, might want to experiment on that side. Or especially when they're saying goodnight to one another outside his door after everything's happened. It's almost like you're waiting for them to kiss one another.
It was definitely there in that scene. And Salmoneo intentionally played his part. And he said this in his biography, and I remember reading things about this, is he intentionally played his part as being smitten with Jim.
Mm-hmm.
And James Dean actually apparently at one point said that to Salmoneo and the director that Plato should look at Jim the way Jim looks at Judy.
Yes.
That subtext is 100%
okay. Then I read that then in that way. And I, when I went back, I mean, there are some questions on whether James Dean had engaged in any homosexual activity. And, you know, he said that I forget the exact quote, but he says life is basically too interesting to just, you know, follow one path or something like that. And there's. So, I mean, it's just very interesting when I watch this, I was like, oh, these two are really in love with one another. And had it been a different time, it would have been totally different. If this movie were made today, Rodrigo, I think they would be the couple.
I don't know. I think even in this movie, it's clear that Plato is really into Jim, but Jim's really into Judy.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
And who isn't into Judy? Holy cow. Va va voom, Natalie Wood.
Yeah. But
I think that there's definitely a subtext there of all of these characters are desperately grabbing onto something to try and, you know, whether it's to make sense of their life, to figure out who they are, what they want to do. You know, keep in mind, halfway through the movie, Judy and Jim are in love. But a third of the way through the movie, Judy had another boyfriend.
Yeah, who just died.
He died horribly, and now all of a sudden they're responding. I mean, but that's so realistic to that teenage experience. I cannot tell you how many times I played out that particular, you know, stupid sort of thought process between the ages of 13 and, let's say, 27.
47?
20. Shut your hole.
Zach, I'm curious, overall, from story perspective, what you thought of this. I mean, this is supposed to be your perspective. It's not just the three old guys talking. Two old guys and a middle-aged guy.
I was watching this, and I thought, in the middle, I really hope this is all a dream, because all these people suck, and I hope there's just some weird, like, olden time epiphany of a lesson learned at the end. He wakes up, and he's either still passed out on the street with that weird monkey thing, which never came back up, but it's a cool-looking monkey thing, or he was just like, he wakes up passed out in the police station, and his parents pick him up, and he's, oh, I'll never booze again, or whatever. Like, that would have made sense, but I was
I'll never major again.
Yeah.
I'll never booze again.
Because I was just like, I was so concerned about the humanity of almost every character, of just how they don't completely care about anyone else because they're trying to figure out where they are. They disregard death.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's just them.
It's everybody.
Yeah, it's everybody. I mean, it's even the parents don't want to think about anybody but themselves.
No, absolutely. Yeah. It's everyone. The parents are. I mean, the mom is trying to not deal with any of her problems by making their family move and kind of putting the blame at her son. Like, she has issues that she is not willing to address. And so does everyone else in this film. And it comes off as horrible selfishness.
After Buzz is dead, Crunch and Goon and Moose, by the way, that's my cover band, my Crosby, Stills, and Nash cover band. Crunch and Goon and Moose.
I thought it was your Archie's cover band.
They come after Jim, right?
Right.
But there's never any real thought process that they're coming after Jim because their friend died.
No.
It's as if they're coming after Jim because they're malicious engines of destruction. And he's something that they just want to crush.
It goes back to what Zach had said. They're going after Jim because they're concerned about themselves. They're concerned that he's going to talk and they're all going to get in trouble, because more than likely it was those three that stole the cars leading to somebody's death. So I think they're really more looking out for themselves.
Mm-hmm. They want to destroy him. Even before the whole thing breaks down, they're all egging Buzz on. And he's like, I'm not going to really knife you. I'm just going to knife you a little bit.
Yeah.
Which, that whole sequence between Buzz and Jim was very homoerotic as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, young Dennis Hopper in this movie.
Yes. Young blonde Dennis Hopper.
Yes, blonde Dennis Hopper. apparently during the filming of the scene, and we'll get to some more technology stuff in a minute. Apparently during the filming of the scene where the kids are all looking over the cliff, there was actually a nuclear test going off. And so I don't know if you could really tell in the movie or if it was a different take, but apparently things light up during the explosion. And that's actually a nuclear bomb going off, and the light from the nuclear bomb illuminating part of that scene.
Wow!
Oh my! Yeah. Zach, any other things that you picked up from the story wise, or what you liked or didn't like from the story?
I can't really say I disliked the story. I think it felt long, but it felt long because it didn't know kind of what it wanted to do at times. I mean, which kind of plays back into the characters. They really don't know what they want to do. And sometimes it felt like the film didn't know where it was going. And I think that it certainly made the film longer.
I think when my son's 15 or 16, I'm going to sit him down and have him watch this movie and see what kind of reaction he has.
Yeah, granted, that'd be interesting.
That's, you know.
Yeah, it's a ways.
Yes, it's a ways away, providing that I'm still alive at the time. Sure. But I just want to see what his reaction, if he suddenly comes to this epiphany of, this is exactly how my life is, mm-hmm. you know, or, you know, those kinds of things. If he starts to see parallels between what's going on at his age and others, because so James Dean died right before this movie was released. The studio still decided to release it. Giant had still not been released yet. And it came out after this, after James Dean's death. But I'm just wondering if this was a huge teenager movie that they watched it because of James Dean, but then also latched onto the story very much like people who watched Titanic went for Leonardo DiCaprio and then ended up staying for the love story.
It's definitely an interesting parallel. And I think that part of the reason that the movie has retained its notoriety is due to the fact that it's kind of a story about a young aimless man who finds out that life is not what he expected it to be and then dies at a strange point. And I think having that parallel in the life of one of the main actors, not necessarily his character, but in the main actor, I think that definitely would bring people to it. But there's a universality to this movie because I didn't grow up in the 50s.
Right.
I didn't grow up in, you know, a family or a lifestyle, anything like this. I found myself really connecting to these characters, feeling, you know, very lost and out of sorts and feeling, you know, yeah, this does remind me of periods of my own life, which sure, we'll call them the teenage years. And I, you know, there are points in this movie when they're, you know, especially the sequence in the swimming pool and directly after the swimming pool, when the characters are so sweet and so wonderful and so vulnerable. And you're like, my God, these are actually some pretty nice little kids. And, you know, I thought that these are some nice kids, but whatever's going on in their life is turning them into these weird psycho murderous bastards doing terrible, terrible things. And I think that, you know, you get to a point where, yeah, I think James Dean's notoriety brings people to the film. And I think that probably that's why it got its first attention. But I think that the story itself, the performances especially, are really, really attractive once you're there.
Cool. Zach, some special people help make this episode happen.
Yes, a lot of special people make this happen. And we call them our associate producers. And now we shout out to them. Aaron Barnes, Ethan Boyd, Fisher Millard, Dominic LaFord, Hannah Jones, Douglas Hopkins, Jimmy Dunn, Steve Jukas, Jeffrey D'Amigo, and Jorge M. Tarohina. Crap. I didn't have it.
You
I never
were doing
had it.
So good.
I was so close.
It's Jorge Tarjeta.
There you go.
No, that's not right.
That's not even close. I didn't even know that.
So anything in this movie look familiar and remind you of maybe another movie that you've seen recently, Zach?
Oh, man. Oh, questions that I should have answers to.
The whole house, the mansion that they end up with, it hits you the moment that you see the swimming pool. This is the location that they shot Sunset Boulevard on.
Yeah.
One could almost imagine that Sunset Boulevard and Rebel Without a Cause are set in the same universe because this is now an abandoned mansion.
Yep.
Left over from What's-Her-Face, who was arrested for killing her lover in the pool.
Oh, wow.
By this point in time, Nora Desmond is dead in a minimum security prison.
Sunset Boulevard came out 5 years before, so if it was in the same universe, I could see that being kind of set up that way. But as soon as you see that swimming pool, I'm like, I swear that is the same swimming pool. Same location that they used for Sunset Boulevard, and then I did some research. Sure enough,
the scene when the cops run up the stairs, I'm like, "That's the same mansion. I know that's the same mansion."
Yeah,
and that for me really sold it. I thought Steven did that on purpose.
No. I completely forgot. But then as I was watching, I was like, "Holy crap! That's the pool from Sunset Boulevard." And then, sure enough. So
I've seen a lot.
What were some technical things that you noticed that you liked, or some techniques that were used that you found interesting in this piece?
There's probably
two of them I would expect that you would bring up.
There's a couple camera moves in the film that seem completely out of place, but totally catch your eye. One of them is when Jim's on the couch and it starts as an upside down shot of his mom.
Oh, sure. POV. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it slowly rotates into the thing. Which completely different to the rest of the film. And then there's two shots where they have just a regular, I don't know, like a two shot or three shot setup, and then they rotate the camera into a Dutch angle.
Right, right, right.
And then they rotate it right back.
Well, they don't rotate it necessarily right back.
No, yeah, it'll pause for a second, get with the thing they needed to shoot in the Dutch, and then go back to the flat angle.
So what does the Dutch angle represent? Because there's a very specific scene when Jim finally has an argument with his father,
mm-hmm.
and it takes place on the staircase, and suddenly everybody it's a normal framing, and then it moves into the Dutch angle. What is the Dutch angle supposed to represent?
Oh, it shows a
psychological imbalance on the part of the character.
Wow. Yeah.
Well,
sure.
Maybe not just that, but just conflict. Right?
Yeah. Something different. That's not normal.
And so in this case, here is this kid lashing out at his parents, which is something you definitely don't do in the 1950s.
Sure.
And then that whole conversation becomes this angle, which the way that they are staged, initially, James Dean is on the stairs talking down to his parents. So he has the upper hand in that argument. Then at one point, his father stands, and because he's closer in that frame, he almost takes command of that scene. And then the mother starts to block Jim's exit out of that scene by climbing up on the stairs and preventing him from going up into his room. And from her standpoint, she becomes the powerful person in the scene. But then the camera pushes in and takes that Dutch angle. And even though they're all staged at different heights, they suddenly all become at the same level, mm-hmm. more or less, and just a little bit off.
Sure.
But this, you know, can indicate that even in this fight, nobody has the upper hand because everybody is confused about what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
One could read it that way. I mean, that's how I read it as.
And psychological imbalance.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was a perfect use of that camera technique.
I like to think of it as I don't know if it actually matches up, but I like to think of it as like the moment where each of them almost sees the other's perspective, but then they don't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It comes really close.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's something where, you know, when it comes to the Dutch angle, puts me in a world where things are off kilter. And when things are off kilter, unease as a viewer when you have that. There's an episode of The Twilight Zone where the whole thing is shot at a Dutch angle. And I didn't realize it at first, but it really made me nervous and it freaked me out. And at the point where somebody pointed out that's why, part of the reason why it's so powerful, I'm like, oh yeah, hey, Beavis. So I liked that whole sequence, with the exception of the part where the camera did the rotate for his head.
Yeah, yeah.
That was weird.
But he didn't actually rotate. We cut back to him, and he's still mm-hmm. there. And I'm like, well, wait. How did – what? Who? What?
Yeah, and that's always tricky when you try to do a stunt shot like that.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't match up to your next shot, it kind of falls apart. There were a lot of things edited out of this movie. Originally, the movie was supposed to be a lot more intense by 1950 standards. You asked about the monkey at the beginning of the scene and where that monkey came from. Originally, the movie was supposed to be opening with these kids beating up a father who was either coming home from work. I forget the whole thing, but, you know, he's the one that drops this monkey. And that's why when Jim drunkenly comes up on the scene later, he finds it. But that's how it got out there in the street. But the studio and the editors all thought that it was a little bit too violent and over the top to see this guy getting beat up by a bunch of teenagers, and was worried about repercussions from the studio system. Sure. So they lopped it out. And I think there's one other scene that was taken out that I guess historical societies are trying to get them to find the raw footage of that and preserve it, because apparently it's an even better scene of James Dean acting in this movie. Even though it was you know, completely taken out for time purposes or whatever purposes in the piece. So mm-hmm. Hello, Slender Man.
Stop that.
Slender Man doesn't make noise.
He does at your house, Rodrigo. Any other technique things that you noticed there, Zach?
I noticed they used really weird colors of lights often.
Did you do any research into this color process that they were using?
I did not.
Okay. I didn't either. I just didn't know if you had because, you know, a lot of times when this happens.
I did. I just wanted to see if you had.
I just wanted to see if you did it. There's a lot of times where suddenly the color will shift. And if you really pay attention to those times where the color really shifts, you notice that it happens right before a fade. And I think that's in the process of creating that fade that the color kind of shifts a little bit.
Oh, I thought it was just a horrible transfer.
Could be that, too, although you and I think watched it through iTunes.
Yeah,
and
I watched it through iTunes.
You know, when they release something that way, generally they take some care. Now, they could have not really cared about the transfer, including a lot of Blu-rays.
Sure.
In the early days, they could give two craps about doing a good, clean transfer or restoring things.
Mm-hmm.
I would bet at some point they will try to restore this to its full glory.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of the wavering or wobbling in some of the color was because that's the transition
process
from one to another.
Yeah.
T-shirt sales soared after James Dean Ward in the film.
Understand.
A t-shirt?
What is this t-shirt?
What is this?
Seriously?
Why is he wearing his undershirt on the outside?
Is it an A shirt?
I did think.
Is it a B shirt?
I like how, by today's standards, for most of the film, the kids are dressed up, kind of.
Yeah, this is what you had to do in the 50s.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But then
Jack
they can, like,
to go to
it's
high
so
school.
Normal to be dressed like that, that it's not a big deal if they're, like, running around and getting dirty and stuff. That's looked down upon. You can't get dirty nowadays.
No, you can't?
No, dirt's bad. It's bad for you.
Oh.
Yeah.
On your boots and your
Somebody
leather
should tell
jacket.
My kids.
Yeah, well, I mean.
Kids are filthy.
Teach their own, I guess.
Does it bother anyone that nobody looks the age that they portray? I mean, James Dean was 24 in this movie and is trying to portray. I mean, I'm sorry, even
Leo
though he's
and Judy both look like teenagers to me.
Even though he's 24, even though he's 24,
yeah.
James Dean still looks like he's 45 years old in that movie.
Yeah, you think
he
so?
Does look a lot older. Him
I don't
and
know
Buzz.
What it, I don't know what it was about the. You know, it seems like anytime you look at old pictures, and I think Scott Johnson mentioned this on one of his shows earlier recently. He said, anytime you look at these oldie-timey photographs,
yep.
You're seeing these people and you're like, holy crap, that guy's like 55, 60. And then you're like,
he's 20.
Tom Jones at age 15. It's like, holy crap, what's the deal going on with this? I mean, today, I mean, James Franco would, back in his Freaks and Geeks years, would have been a perfect fit to play Jim Stark in a remake of Rebel Without a Cause.
I was thinking Ryan Gosling about 5 years
Except
ago.
Except neither of those guys have the gravitas for the role. But Natalie Wood was like 17 when they shot this movie, wasn't she? I thought she was born in 39.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't know either. But Plato looked like a 15-year-old kid. Salmoneo in this movie looked like a 15-year-old kid.
Well, he was born in 39.
So he would have been 17, 16 in
1935. Yeah, something like that.
Hollywood, 1938.
Yeah, so she would have been 17 at the time of this movie. But she only felt like a kid in the scenes where she was playing against her ever so creepy and disturbing father. Because when you take her out of that, and I think part of it is the fact that, and forgive me, this is going to seem indelicate, ladies' undergarments in the 50s were designed to look like giant tops of rockets.
Well, it was called the bullet bra for a reason.
Well, I understand.
Or the rocket bra.
Natalie Wood at 17 wearing that out of context of other children or out of a context where she seems like a child, she seems like a woman with giant gazongas. And I'm, you know, I'm like watching this film and going, she looks like a teenager in certain sequences, and then in other places she looks like a grown woman of 20 or 25.
Yeah. So. Mm-hmm. Well, and I think part of that problem too is your only other people that you can compare that to are the two mothers and the grandmother that show up in the scene. There is another quote unquote girlfriend that is in the Griffith Observatory scene. Mm-hmm. But other than that, you don't have any other frame of reference for young women in this movie.
Yeah. How old was Buzz? Let's see. Corey Allen. Corey Allen would have been only 21 in this movie.
Yeah. I don't know. It just seems even when I look at this, it's like, these guys look ancient even at that age.
James Dean, though, has one of those faces where I imagine that at 6 years old, he was like, I need a Marlboro.
Yeah.
I need some bourbon, Mom. It was a tough day at kindergarten.
You're tearing me apart.
It's
funny.
And
you know what else I thought about during that you're tearing me apart scene and the laughing at the bottom of the pool?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden is doing a very impressive James Dean.
Mm-hmm.
because that laugh at the bottom of the pool is the exact same laugh that Tyler Durden does in the "You don't know where I've been, Lou" sequence of Fight Club.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout that movie, you know, I'm like, why do bits of James Dean's performance feel so familiar? I'm like, Brad Pitt was totally doing James Dean in that movie, or part of that movie anyway.
It's funny. I'm looking at, you know, pictures of Natalie Wood, and I'm trying to find pictures from her with Rebel Without a Cause, but I can't find. Yeah, funny. You know, it takes you a while before you find anything from that movie. Most of the stuff came in her later life.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Fun fact, it is as the day we were recording.
Be careful when you say fun fact, because we don't want to turn this into some bad Golden Globes debacle.
Yeah, no joke. The day we're recording, it is Jim Backus's birthday.
Happy birthday, Mr. Howell.
Yes.
Yeah, he would be, what, 100 now?
Let's click on his profile.
1913. So, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, almost. Geez.
Yeah, because in 1964, he was roughly 50 years old as Mr. Howell. But, yeah, and the Jim Backus in this movie.
I think it was an interesting choice to cast him. I really do.
It was. Well, I don't know that he was necessarily known as a super broad comic actor quite yet, but I think, you know, the voiceover work of Mr. Magoo, clearly he's someone that now we think of as, you know, bug-eyed comic guy. Lovey, my teddy.
Right, right, right.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point in time, and the performance that he delivers here, knowing how incredibly good he is at chewing the crap out of the bamboo scenery, I really can appreciate the subtlety of the role of the spineless dad that he puts into this, because there's moments where you see a little glimmer of the Jim Backus that I know and expect, especially near the end and at the observatory. But most of the time he just feels like he's so broken and so,
well, he is
spineless.
Yeah.
Yeah, go get him, Tiger. Remember, don't let him pick you. You pick them. And I'm like, dude, what is
He's trying to be hip. I mean, he's like 50 and his kids and his 24-year-old kids are still in high school. He's trying to be supportive in some way,
Dad,
shape,
I'm
or form.
Go crash cars. Well, you just make sure you crash them good, son.
The thing that I didn't realize about Jim Backus, just as an aside, I didn't realize that he's not actually an upper Manhattan sort of Massachusetts. Right. He's from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And
hey, Cleveland rocks.
Cleveland does rock. I think Rodrigo lived in Cleveland, didn't he?
No.
Shaker Heights?
No.
Solon?
Yeah. Parma.
Parma.
That is Drew Carey territory.
It is Drew Carey territory. Drew Carey-tory, if you will.
Let me ask you this other question. At the very last shot, we're doing this big pull away, Zach, the police cars are leaving and we see this man walking towards the observatory. That is director. What's his name? Ray is his last name.
Nicholas. Ray.
Nicholas Ray. And it's there because I guess he wants to interject himself into his films, very much like what we see Alfred Hitchcock.
It was a thing,
I guess. What are your thoughts, Zach, on you interjecting yourself into a movie just so you can say, look, there's me? And
yeah, it's weird because even Hitchcock, so he started doing it and then it became a thing of like, oh,
spot the Hitchcock.
When's Hitchcock gonna be here? So then he had to start putting it earlier in the film because then people could get out of their system. They wouldn't have to worry about it anymore.
Right.
So
I mean, a lot of directors have done this. Spielberg and Lucas have done it in the Indiana Jones movies and in the Star Wars movies. They've done it. I'm just curious what.
Yeah,
your,
I don't
your
know. I mean,
Tommy Wiseau did it.
I don't have. I guess I really don't
Peter
have a problem
Jackson
with it.
Does it?
Yeah.
Does he really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Peter Jackson's in. Sadly. I think every Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Movie.
Is he an orc?
He's a hobbit in one. He's a townsman on Lake Town in this other one. He and Steve Colbert.
Yeah.
And in the third one in
is he an eagle?
No, he's in one of them, he's in Helm's Deep. Raggled guy.
He's a zombie
fighting out for his life.
Yeah.
I mean, Stan Lee keeps putting himself in all his damn movies. So.
Only in movies where he's had a role in creating those characters.
I know. If only he was the director, that'd be weird.
Stan Lee had a role in creating a lot of characters.
Sure. I guess I don't have a problem with it unless it becomes a thing. And then
well,
I think
it's
becomes
one thing
prohibitive to your film.
Put yourself in your movie, but it's another thing to, you know, star in your movie.
Sure. Well, I mean, some people do that. I mean, Affleck did that. I mean, he directed and starred in Argo.
That's a little bit different, though, beyond just inserting yourself
well,
as a cameo.
He said if you're going to star, I think there's a thing, but just putting yourself in your movie to put yourself in the movie.
Tommy Wiseau.
I mean, I don't know. I guess I don't know what the benefit is.
He's also being torn apart.
Honestly, I think the when a director puts himself in the movie, it basically serves two purposes. One, the director is now in his movie,
mm-hmm.
which means that because when somebody watches a movie, they can't see the director, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can see all the work the director did, but they can't see them. And even if it's not obvious that that person's the director of this movie, now you're in the movie, and at some point somebody has seen you. So I think it makes sense in that
Interesting.
Sense.
Yeah.
The other one, in a way, it's like an initial, right? Or like a signature or something like that.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. The other one is that directors like it when people talk about their movies, and being spotted as a cameo for like film people is a lot more fun. Did you know that you know the angry guy who shakes his fist as a protagonist is actually director of photography Rodney Sidney Times
Snot Pockets?
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. Or did you know that juror number 12 is actually Rodriguez?
Yeah. Did you know that Judge Ito is actually not in this movie?
Well, I think it's if it's just there to be there and it's something you find out after the fact, I could care either way. I think it's a little bit of an ego driven thing. But when it becomes that deal of spot the director, and again, Peter Jackson in the second Hobbit movie did it right away. I mean, the opening shot of the town that everything's happening in, he walks through that scene in the very first shot and you get it done with really quickly.
Yeah.
I kind of
but
like
when it becomes that game, I don't care for it. I like to be surprised by things as opposed to here comes the Stan Lee cameo.
I kind of like that. I liked the fact that Hitch put himself in his movies, but it's different when you're an Alfred Hitchcock, because Alfred Hitchcock as a director had a unique sort of visibility from his time, you know, on television. And even before that, people knew, oh, hello, I talk like this, I'm Alfred Hitchcock. There's kind of, a little bit of that myth making at play. And if you can pull it off, if you're somebody like a Hitchcock who by all accounts was an utter lunatic, you know, you can, and I mean that in the sweetest way possible, please don't sue. You can get away with that. I feel like that's an okay thing. It's nice to have a little signature thing, but it's also something that could easily become problematic and very easily go over the top.
I feel like it only becomes problematic when they're just in a scene and they don't do anything. I mean, like Tarantino's in a lot of his own films, and he has small parts in Pulp Fiction. He's a small part in Django Unchained from last year.
He gives himself spotlight roles. I mean, Jimmy is a key role in Pulp Fiction, and he put himself in that key role.
Yeah.
And there's an
M. Night Shyamalan's the same way. He actually, when he makes a quote-unquote cameo in a movie, he's actually a fairly important plot device.
I mean, and Kevin Smith is in there in Clerks and all those movies.
Right.
And I guess I don't care as much at that point. I think I'm more fine with you are in your movie as an actor and you contribute something to the overall plot of the film instead of it's not a Where's Waldo kind of game.
Which, but I mean, the Where's Waldo game can be fun.
No, certainly can be fun.
Especially in that Where's Waldo movie.
Yeah.
And furthermore, though, the Where's Waldo thing usually doesn't interfere with the movie.
Hopefully.
Right. Hopefully not.
It's something that you can bring to it to appreciate. And, you know, with a Kevin Smith thing, it's kind of like, I don't necessarily think of Kevin Smith as doing that, because Kevin Smith comes from a place where he played Silent Bob because he didn't have anybody else to play.
But again, that is very, very different. I mean, what I'm talking about is, I'm just going to pop myself in this shot because I think it'll be cool.
Yeah.
As opposed to I'm playing Kevin Smith and my character is this, or I'm Ben Affleck and I think I can be the best person in this role. That's a lot different than
absolutely.
Hey, let me just you remember that third guy walking behind the Sith Lord in scene 27 of this shot? That was George Lucas. You know, that's the stuff
that is in Star Wars.
Yeah, he's walking to.
He's in at least one of the prequels.
Yeah, he's in one of the prequels. Second one in the prequel.
His are in the third prequel.
Right.
Yeah. He's in Empire.
Number two.
He took off his shirt and talked like Uta Gita Uta Solo. He's all over that movie.
Terrible. All right, Zach, anything else you want to add? What did you learn? What are you going to use? What are you going to adapt?
I learned to make your movie tight. Get a couple eyes to look at that. Edit it. Walk away from a couple days. Edit that thing down some more because geez and beats. That's important. And, you know, you can mix up your shot style every once in a while and it not be totally horrible. You can go against the flow of the norm of the day.
Okay. You
can get something cool.
Did the fiance watch this with you?
No.
Why not?
Because she was putting labels on our save the dates. That's what she was doing.
What's the date again, in case people want to send you gifts?
August 2nd. August
2nd.
Don't send me gifts. Really don't send me gifts. You have no idea where to send them, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
General delivery, Kansas.
Yeah.
How did Zach do on this, Rodrigo?
I think he did well. He clearly spent some time thinking about the movie, analyzing its properties, and looking at what different things mean. You know, the only real weakness in his approach is that he saw some of the strange techniques, but didn't spend a lot of time thinking about what they meant, which, you know, I mean, it's good that he noticed them. So I wouldn't come down on him too hard. I'll give him a pass, but just remember for the future, just for your own comfort in this show, if something weird happens in a movie, you should at least come up with a read of it.
Noted. Thank you, Overlord Rodrigo.
There you go. All right, Zach, take us out of here.
Oh, okay. That's going to be it for Zach on Film this week. Make sure to head over to majorspoilers.com. And give your thoughts on Rebel Without a Cause in the podcasting posting page. While you're on Major Spoilers, make sure to click on that Amazon.com link where you can go buy a cool red jacket and you can wear it all the time. And well, it's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit will come back to Major Spoilers to keep all the shows we produce for you completely free and coming to you regularly week after week after week after week. So next week on Zach on Film, we're going to be talking Taxi Driver.
That is correct.
And that will be next time on Zach on Film.